I love Bigfoot, too.
God.
I believe in Bigfoot. I don't know if you believe in Bigfoot. I'm here to tell you, you're allowed. I love believing in Bigfoot. I love talking about it publicly, too, because if you talk about it publicly, everyone thinks you're crazy. But I love believing in Bigfoot. I believe in Bigfoot for one very important reason, because hundreds, thousands of people have claimed to see Bigfoot over the years. And I don't think they're all liars. But we live in the modern Western world, right, where we no longer have the high priest telling our culture what to believe in. Now we have the high scientist. They sit on their thrones of textbooks, like, oil my genitals and I'll tell you about the cosmos. The universe is 98% dark energy and dark matter, but no one's ever seen it, but that's the truth. Well, guess what thousands of people have seen, motherfucker? Bigfoot. Okay. Oh, they didn't see Bigfoot. They're mistook in what they saw. They're not as smart as we are. We'll tell them what they really saw. It's like, dude, you can't tell someone what they saw if you weren't there. Shit, that's not how this works. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter how much evidence you give a skeptic, whether they want to believe in Bigfoot or whether they want to believe in God. If they have already made up their mind that they're not changing it, it doesn't matter what you present them. You know what I mean? They'll always move that line in the sand a little bit further back. Like, well, if there were photos of Bigfoot, I'd believe. And then boom, all these photos start popping up over the years. Ah, anybody could have photoshopped those. Oh, really? You think anybody could have photoshopped those? Then you've never tried to photoshop before. People go to college for years to become decent at Photoshop. And you think any jerk with a laptop can shop a Squatch? That's unreasonable. Well, if there was video evidence of Sasquatch, that would be definitive proof of the existence of the cryptid. Then I would believe. Go home tonight, get on YouTube, type in the word Bigfoot. You will find hundreds and hundreds of videos. A few of them actually have a Bigfoot in them. There's this one that has... There's security camera footage from a national park, right? And it's got five Sasquatch hanging out by a riverbed during the winter. It's mind-blowing. It's beautiful, right? It's like, oh, it's a digitally animated fake. Yeah, Jed from Ludlow, Kentucky. He took a break from working on that new Star Wars movie so he could make you this Bigfoot video. Because he wanted to be more popular down at the clickbait shop on Saturdays. Just unreasonable. I mean, I would argue that there's more video evidence of Bigfoot out there than there is of God. Show me one video of God and I'll believe. But you better hope it's not blurry. How come nobody who takes a picture of God has a good camera, huh? Is that a coincidence? I'm not one of those comedians who's going to tell you you can't believe in God. You're allowed to believe in God. If I believe in Bigfoot, you're allowed to believe in Jesus. How big of a jerk would I be if I'm like, you know, the Sasquatch is real, but the walking on water, that's fucking crazy, you know? Maybe Jesus was just a Bigfoot doing chaos magic. I don't know. Sounds pretty cool to me if he was.
Hey, what's up, sinners and choosers? Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you for tuning in. That track you just heard is from my guest today, Ryan Singer, who I was so lucky to have on the show. That track is from his new album called Free Love, which is it's free, as the name would imply. You can get it for free on his website, ryansingercomedy.com. You can get it on Google Play. That's where I listened to it most recently. Spotify, wherever. Just, it's free. All he asks is that you rate it or review it, and it's a great album. Vulture named it one of the top 10 of 2018. So do it. Get it. There's no reason not to. It's free. You can also get his album on the feed of his podcast, which is really an incredible podcast called Me and Paranormal You. And if you're into this show because you like alternative spirituality, Ryan does an incredible job of thoroughly researching, way more research than I put into this show. And it's just great. Me and Paranormal You, that's the name of the podcast. It's free. This podcast is also free. Please take a second to rate or review this podcast on whatever source you're listening to it from. Also, January 25th, if you're in the Los Angeles area, we have a live Choose Your Own Religion coming up at Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church in Pasadena. And I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty psyched for this. I'm trying not to geek out too much about being able to put on my live show at a Unitarian Universalist Church. And it's going to be an awesome time of people sharing stories, doing some other weird fun stuff. It's going to be a great time. And the fact that they would even be willing to put it on at their church is exactly why I want to become a Unitarian Universalist minister, because I feel like I can bring my whole weird self to it, and I can be authentic. We're going to have unfiltered conversations, not going to be censored. Nobody's checking to make sure they meet a certain content, whatever. We're going to have storytellers booked who have been on The Moth and stuff, but you can also tell a story. I want people who have never told a story before to tell a story on this thing. That's what it's for. It's for us to share our stories with each other. It's not just to hear a polished performance. You know, it's about us having authentic relationships with each other. Send me an email to joe@chooseyourownreligion.com if you're thinking about coming and telling a story. January 25th, you can find more info on the Facebook page. That's where the event for it will be. You can also find old episodes of this podcast on chooseyourownreligion.com. And that's it. I really love this podcast. I love this conversation with Ryan. He was an incredible guest. I love you. Thank you for being the light that you are. Please give it up for Ryan.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
Thanks for coming over, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I was listening to your album and your podcasts over... I was just driving up to San Francisco and back the past couple of days, so I just got in last night. I was reacquainting myself with you. And I actually remember, I think I remember seeing you. You would not, we didn't like interact, but I remember seeing you, I feel like at a UCB show like 5-6 years ago. Did you have bigger hair at some
point?
Yeah, I had
much bigger hair.
And I remember, I just remember you being like a force to like reckon. Like, it took us a while as an audience to like settle in with your energy.
Yeah, that happens at like a spot like the UCB for me.
Mm-hmm.
And like maybe even like a place like the Laugh Factory, well.
Yeah.
That it takes a moment, like not always, but I feel like there's like a moment of like transition for an audience trying, especially at the Laugh Factory,
right. But I love your style is this very like poetic kind of like flowing sort of like not quite stream of consciousness, but it's I don't know, it has like a... it's hard to describe. There's a certain, like, it's a flowing rant, but not, like, rant makes it sound, like, angrier than it really is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, there is, like, definitely, I've kind of discovered this natural, I guess, what is more comfortable for me naturally.
Yeah.
To kind of express my ideas, and there's a lot of, you know, like quick breaths to, like, catch myself and to keep going. Yeah. As opposed to, like, say somebody, I mean, I think, like, the total opposite of me in style would kind of be, like, a Stephen Wright or, you know, like a Hedberg. Right. Like, somebody who's very, you know, dry and, like, these are the jokes I've written. Uh-huh. All I have to do is speak them with seemingly the lowest energy you've ever heard.
Right.
You're going to love them.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I'm like, I really got to bring this to you.
Sure, yeah. Wait, how long have you been doing comedy now?
Probably 16 years.
Oh, wow. Now. Did you ever experiment with any of like the one-liner style?
My style has changed for sure.
Yeah.
Over the years. You know, as we find ourselves. But I think, ironically, I'm very similar to how I was when I first started open mics. I had this idea of stand-up comedy being art.
Sure.
Which I still firmly hold on to.
Yeah.
And I was like, no one can tell me what to do. Right? And so I was like, no one will tell me what to do or how to be. So I was very just kind of stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
But the problem with that for me was, one, I wasn't getting any work as a young comic because my stream of consciousness is always out of the gate. It's very filthy.
Right.
Are not like extremely, but it's pretty, you know, I like adult words.
Sure, yeah.
I remember being a kid. I didn't have any friends until I cussed. Like, so it was like a profound moment in my life, like being in school, like being on recess and then finding this new kid who just transferred to our school.
Yeah.
Because his family moved and being like, let's cuss. And he's like, we can't do that. Because it was a Catholic school, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, he's like, we'll get in trouble. I was like, no, we won't. Watch. And I said, like, shit.
Uh-huh.
And then we freaked out. But we realized we didn't get in trouble. And like that was like my one of my first real connections with another kid.
Yeah.
And I also remember loving stand-up comedy as a kid too. And thinking like, I want to make adults laugh. I don't care about these kids. You know, like I was like over kids as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Like these kids, I don't care if these kids laugh at me because they're stupid.
Right.
Now adults are smart and they travel the world and you know
I like a lot of adults.
Yeah,
there's a lot of adults I look up to.
Yeah, yeah.
I look up to any kid.
They keep me alive.
Right.
And so I was like, I'm going to make adults laugh someday. And so I think that really formed me.
Wow.
Or it at the very least, it informed my sense of humor and like how I wanted to be funny.
Sure, yeah.
And I just kind of grew with that. But the problem with that at the time was you can't be an MC. Mm. At a comedy club in the Midwest doing that.
Mm. Was this Ohio?
This was Ohio, yeah. And I was also very angry at the time. Like, so I had a lot of anger towards God and, and like my failed relationships. So like it just wasn't very good. I mean, I'm sure there were some ideas in there that like I could revisit and be like, oh, you know, I was onto something.
Right, right.
But you know, you kind of get lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I kind of had to change my style and try to write clean. Because I was like, if I want to be a working comic, I have to, at least for now. I was like, I'll Trojan horse this. And then once I'm in the door, I can do whatever I want.
I feel like that's the case with so many fields, like just needing to, as you're saying, Trojan horse it. Like we all, I feel like, well, at least I don't even want to say with the ways that, like, I don't know if you know, I recently am transitioning out of, I guess, comedy, traditional comedy and storytelling into, I'm going to seminary in fall of 2019 to be a Unitarian Universalist minister.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a part of me that like sees things I would like the UU world to do differently, but I feel like a little bit I have to, you know, just go, I have to learn how they do it first.
Sure.
Learn the language and then be like, prove I have chops and like can, you know, hang with them, so to speak.
Yeah, but it is definitely a prove you have chops thing. And I think that's the thing that maybe I was lacking before I ever started stand-up comedy. I always loved stand-up comedy. I always respected the history of it, but I didn't understand the craft.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the toolbox.
Yeah.
That went along with it. And so when I tried to transition into getting work, you know, writing clean jokes that weren't topical, that were evergreen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I could tell this joke in 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, like building blocks of an act.
Right, right.
I started to get work. It's amazing, right?
Did you feel this like disconnection? Because I've felt this before with some of my material where my favorite bits never worked. Like the stuff I really loved and thought was the coolest.
Sure, yeah.
But then, like, it was just maybe it was so specific or it was a context that I didn't realize only I fully appreciated. But then the stuff, there'd be so many things that, like, just felt like dumb throwaway stuff that people just absolutely
That is weird when that happens.
Ate up, yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, maybe my barometer isn't exactly precise like I think it is. About what people will think is funny. And I think we all have our great white whale, you know?
Yeah.
That's like a joke that's just, wow, how did this not?
Yeah.
I think I'm smart enough to understand why my great white whale never really worked. there was this really silly thing called the pronoun game.
Uh-huh.
And to the point where this joke was so weird and dumb that I had a general manager of a comedy club where I was kind of, you know, hanging out all the time, tell me like, you can't do that bit anymore. Like threatening me.
Wow.
Like to never go on stage again.
Wow.
Because he was just tired of me trying it, I think.
And it's just about pronouns.
It's just, yeah.
Sounds harmless.
Yeah, it's very harmless, but it's one of these things where I think it's like a good encapsulation of who I am. It's like, I get the audience. I'm like, you want to play a game, whatever? And they'll be like, yeah, of course. And I'll be like, okay, it's called the pronoun game. And I'm just being really silly about it.
Uh-huh.
And I'll like list the pronouns, like second person, personal pronouns, he, they'll yeah, he, she,
uh-huh.
it, And I'll be like, now say him real fast. He should. You know, like it's like something, like just trying to make people cuss with using pronouns.
Uh-huh.
He shit, where, there, me, you, we. It's like, me, you, we. Like, anyway, so it was like the dumbest thing, right? And I loved it so much, and I wanted to like make it this big thing. And then, but I was like wrong. I was definitely wrong. Because people were just like, what's happening? But the good news for me was that when you, or when I at least challenged myself to write clean jokes that I thought were funny, mm-hmm. which was the important, because I'm not going to sit here and act like clean comedy isn't funny, because Brian Regan's one of the funniest people that's ever lived.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's a great example, but there's, but it taught me like joke writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then over the years I developed the, I studied, I got more into the craft of it.
Yeah.
And so now I'm in this point where I'm like, my style is back to how I kind of started.
That's cool.
Strangely enough.
Like a little hero's journey.
Yeah.
In an artistic way.
But now I have the toolbox. Now I have like the tool belt around my waist.
Yeah.
As opposed to just showing up on the construction site like, let's build this house, man.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, no, you can't just use your hands, bro.
That's cool.
So, yeah. So it's been a fun journey.
I think something you're talking about with like, with clean comedy. I mean, I feel like everybody likes clean comedy. It's just good clean comedy. You don't think of it as clean comedy.
You just think of it as comedy.
Right. But like, it almost, and I was like trying to think about my own relationship to quote unquote clean comedy. It almost feel, not all clean comedy maybe feels this way. Like I don't feel this way necessarily about Seinfeld, but like, I think a lot of clean comedy almost has a quote for like a quote unquote dirty feel in the sense of it has a subversive, like sort of like it's attacking something. Or like not even attacking in a mean way. Like, you know, it's like you're saying something that's like, oh wow, I can't believe like somebody would think of that angle. Like, I don't know, Brian Regan, Brian Regan maybe not is the best example of this, but
well, he has a bit about the Native Americans, and I'm trying to remember specifically. Oh shoot, now I'm like blanking on it, but I do know what you mean. Like, there's, I mean, and Regan's got that the doofus voice, which is like uh-huh. hysterical. And there's like there's many great comedians currently, like contemporaries who are clean, like Andy Woodhull, Tommy Jonigan,
Gaffigan,
yeah. Joe Zimmerman.
Uh-huh.
There's lots of people, and I'm sure I'm forgetting some, like just off the top of my head. But there's plenty of guys and gals out there who are working quote unquote clean.
Yeah.
That, you know, are hysterical.
Right. Or like somebody like, I don't know, I guess Chase Bernstein. I think of her, she's a pretty clean cop.
Yeah, I'd say so.
If it's not technically clean, it could be. I don't know.
I think so.
I love Chase.
Yeah, I think so. And then like, but for my stand-up, I've realized like the more I want to talk about like the truth of, excuse me, some of the darkness I've been through, that I like to use in like juxtaposition about how like how beautiful I think it is to be alive.
Yeah.
It's like it gets into like my battles with drug addiction and you know, sex addiction and so things like that. So it's just by nature it's a very adult topic.
For sure.
I mean, so trying to clean that up is I mean, sure you could clean it up, but it's like an audience that really wants like specifically clean comedy. That's not the content that they're really looking for.
Yeah.
They're looking for the squeaky wheel on the grocery cart. They're not looking
something
for
something their kids can listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not looking for the guy trying to tell a clean version of why he wants to do cocaine every morning when he wakes up.
Right. Yeah. That's, I mean, this is all stuff I'm like, I have like three different threads. I don't know if you ever feel this in your podcast, or there's like three potential conversation threads you could choose from. So I'm just going to go with one that I'm thinking about right now is, I mean, as I'm like, it's a weird transition for me doing this. I just came back from visiting like six seminaries in the past 2 weeks. So like now I'm fully in like, oh, this is what it means to be like around people who are also like looking to do ministry. But it's weird even, it feels weird even when I say I'm like looking at seminaries or I'm looking to be a minister, people already start looking at you differently, kind of in the way, I guess, when you introduce yourself as a comedian in some way, they feel like people go like, that. Oh, like there's sure. a weird thing. But I don't want to lose the art, like the artist side of me that has gotten used to kind of being able to say whatever I feel like I want to talk about, and at least subject wise, what you know what I'm saying? And like, I feel like a lot of people say they want that out of like their ministry. Like, oh, people love like the idea of like the tattooed minister with like a drug addiction past. But then sometimes I feel weird abrasion when trying to broach those subjects. Like, I don't know, I haven't even preached a sermon yet, so I don't even know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but for me it resonates because I have this conversation recently more than, and it's a conversation I never really thought I'd have. The idea of, like, just by sheer nature of my podcast and like the type of material, and just from like my, you know, passion and being interested in like all things supernatural, mystical, yeah, esoteric, paranormal, that it's led me, like, the last 5 years I've gone down this rabbit hole, and just by, without even really planning it, I've read all these books now, and like, and so it's informed my stand up in a way that I never anticipated. So my last album that just came out, it's like, you know, 70% of the tracks, if just you look at the title of the track, it's like all crystals, magic,
I
Bigfoot, teleportation, singularity,
yeah,
talk to your water. So it's like, it's really changed, like, I've changed as a person. But when it comes to bringing, I don't want to, I've never really been like, I want to be a part of the paranormal world, right? Like,
yeah,
that's never been like my, like, mission necessarily, as much as I'm a person who's interested in the paranormal. I am part of that world.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't need to become a part of a world that I already am a part of. And
right,
I think the conversation is, can we expand this world?
Mm.
Like, there's, you know, I'm a part of like a UFO group here in town. you know, it's called UPARS, UFO Paranormal Research Society.
That's awesome.
You know, I, at one time or another, I have been a member of the Theosophy, mm-hmm, Society, which is different than the, like, the Lodge of Theosophy, or the Theosophy Lodge, which is just like theology and philosophy. Anyway, it's like, I love all that ancient esoteric stuff.
Yeah.
And like these mystery schools. And like, okay, give me this knowledge. Where are these Rosicrucians hiding? Mm. Okay, there's a Freemason lodge in Glendale I'm like looking into. Like, yeah, I want this knowledge. You know what I mean? And for me, like, a mystery school is a seminary. A seminary is it's like also a mystery school. Mm-hmm. It's got ancient esoteric, it's got knowledge just that is, you know, thousands of years old, mm-hmm, that you're getting, you know, access to in a formal setting, as
right,
opposed to just like, you know, doing deep dives on the internet. But it's about bringing your unique perspective to these things. And I would like to hope that, you know, through my stand-up comedy, I can bring more people into the fold of paranormal, understanding that, like, oh yeah, I'm interested in this too. I never would have considered myself to be a part of this community, but it turns out I have been this whole time.
Yeah.
I've just never identified in that way.
Yeah.
So I think, like, different voices, unique voices, new ways of doing things bring people into the feeling of community.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm,
in that way, like with ministry, I mean, comedy is, I don't think I have to convince you of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we obviously both agree that comedy is the most effective way to communicate anything.
Right.
I mean, I remember being a kid, being raised in Southern Ohio, Republican family,
mm-hmm,
like hating Bill Clinton when he was first, right? Hating Bill Clinton. And I'm watching C-SPAN one day. As a very young man, I was like very interested in politics.
Uh-huh.
And he made me laugh.
Hmm.
And I'm watching him like out of spite. I'm watching, yeah, this press conference thing he's doing. This, like, it was like at a journalist's lunch, uh-huh, or something, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He makes me laugh. And in that moment, I realize, yeah, he's got me. You know what I mean? Like, he's got me, man.
Yeah.
He made me laugh. And I think Justin Timberlake was the same way for me the first time he did SNL and they had Dick in the Box. Like, anybody,
oh, that's
who
a great point with JT. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody who didn't like JT, like, he made you laugh on SNL, you're on board with JT now.
That's so true. There were so many people that were like, you know, fuck Backstreet Boys or NSYNC, whoever, like, fuck boy bands, like, at least in my generation.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, I'm a little bit younger than you, and I reached of age where I, like, they were huge when I was in fifth and sixth grade. So, like, fifth grade, it was cool to like the Backstreet Boys. Sixth grade was immediately totally uncool to like the Backstreet Boys. Like, there was a switch had just flipped where all of a sudden, sixth grade, all my friends were like, oh yeah, Green Day rocks, Blink-182
rocks.
You're
in sixth grade now.
But yeah, NSYNC sucks. It was literally that night and day. Like, my first album was an NSYNC album. And then immediately I had to just disavow them.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Just a year
See,
later.
Like, New Kids on the Block broke when I was at that age.
Oh, gotcha, yeah.
And they took over everything as far as, like, you know, suburban white girls' minds.
Right.
And I was dating a girl at the time, if you can even call it that at that age. But and then we went to the mall, as you do. And she dragged me into a hat store and started making me wear those, like, the fully circular brimmed hats that what's his name? Joey McIntyre, who was JT before JT was JT.
Right.
He was just the, you know, the curly haired kid in the group. And she made me try on hats. And I'm like, you're making me put these hats on because I have curly, I have a curly afro.
Yeah.
And you love Joey McIntyre. And she's like, no, no, I just think you look good in the hat. And I'm like, I know what's happening here. Like, I'm not an idiot.
Not if only Joey Mack had been funnier, then he would have been like a pop super, you know, superstar.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, who knows? And maybe he just, maybe he is just as funny as JT and just was never given the platform to be so. But he, but yeah, like when someone makes you laugh, it's over.
Yeah.
At least for me. So, the like you're on board, and so I think when it comes to something like the ministry, or there was only growing up Catholic, there was probably only two or three priests ever that made me laugh, and those priests were well renowned as the like, oh, you got to see this guy,
effective,
and like people talked about him, like, oh, you're gonna love this priest,
right?
And it's because the and half the time. They were using just kind of like hacky street jokes.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And
yeah.
But they worked for everybody. I mean, people love hack jokes because they live hack lives.
Also, the bar is so low as a minister. Like, and the setting of it being in a church when it's so stuffy most of the time, at least in like Protestant or Catholic, like traditional church. I grew up Presbyterian, so it was, anytime somebody just said the slightest joke or said the slightest thing that didn't quite fit, like when you wouldn't normally expect to hear. Which could be even just talking about a sports team in like a funny way.
Sure.
Maybe like a dig at the local, you know, your hated like fan base. Like if somebody was like, oh yeah, well, too bad for all you Raiders fans here or whatever down in LA, that would have gotten like a huge laugh or something like that, you know, in that context. But
there is a part of me that like had to like get over that when I was a very young comic. I was like very like anti-hack, like this is like this is supposed to be, you know. And it's like then I realized, well, you know, and I don't mean it in a negative way when I say people love hack jokes because they live hack lives. And it's just because people are, there's certain commonalities that show up throughout life.
That's right.
That everyone experiences, and in the world of comedy, because we can be bastards, we call it hack. You know what I mean? When something's too common, that means it's not good anymore. So, but I'll tell you what, my girlfriend and I, there's nothing better than I love than like, not too long ago, I was like, can we just have like a normal person date night? So we were in Alhambra. We went to a Wingstop, walked around a mall, and I'm like, I feel like a person.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like a person again. And I'm like, oh, this is how people live. You know, like this is enjoyable. This is calm, relaxing. Mm-hmm. We're having a good time. Like there's nothing wrong with it.
Right. Well, that and kind of related to what we're talking about, I feel like is something that what you're saying about you as a young comic resonates with me so hard. I when I got into comedy, I got into it because I love the idea of it being a place of free expression. That was what I loved about comedy, being able to say whatever I wanted after growing up in a really religious household, and all of a sudden I wasn't religious anymore and I could just say whatever I wanted. And you know, so it was all about being like a pure, honest, like expressing myself. But something I heard years later was the idea that you know, it's important to shift from expression to communication, especially as a comic, because communication takes the other person into account. Whereas expression is just kind of more selfish. I mean, not to say, you know, I'm not really shitting on all kinds of expression, but you know what I'm saying? Like communication has a degree of empathy built into that mechanism where you're curious about where they're coming from and how you can meet them where they are, which, I mean, when I listen to your podcast, and by the way, it feels like weird because I feel like this is I know you also, we all have like a number of one-sided relationships, like artistic relationships.
Oh,
with somebody,
yeah, sure.
Where it's like, oh, I've like listened to your album and I've like heard your podcast and you don't really know as much about me. But when I was listening to your album and then contrasting it with your podcast, which goes super deep on all these, on a huge variety of paranormal subjects, I feel like in your album and your comedy, I can feel you trying to meet them where they are, like the audience, because they're not, you can't go, you don't have time to go into like the whole context of, you know, past live stuff or the whole context of whatever, telekinesis or something like
that. Sure, yeah. And I don't have the kind of, like, and I don't have like a Patton Oswalt fan base.
Right.
Or, you know, like people don't for the most part, people don't know who I am. So it's not like people are showing up like downloaded with all that information already.
Right.
Because they're into it or something.
Right.
And so I can just be like, okay, so we all know this. Mm-hmm. We're all familiar with Dr. Brian Weiss and, you know, Many Lives, Many Masters, the past life hypnosis or book. So let's, so how about this deep cut? You know, like,
yeah.
You know, so, you know, you kind of have to, there is something that is a really great way to explain it between the shift between expression and communication. And I think expression is it's a defense mechanism when you're starting out because, mm-hmm. you know, I had this conversation just a few days ago with another comic. It's, we were talking about, you know, being younger, and it's like, you know, you at some point having the punchline isn't as important as like showing the audience that like, I'm not afraid to say anything. Mm. I'm not afraid to go anywhere. And so then they'll just be like, ooh, like, wow, this person, they might end up going somewhere someday. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I think about like going to open mics now, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, after 16 years, it's a totally different viewpoint. Like me thinking about, could I start over in stand-up comedy starting today?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I don't even like to think about that question.
Especially
right?
in LA versus somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. Or you know, just like even anywhere.
Anywhere.
And and I think like, ugh, you know, you have to be so blinded by your desire to, you know, yeah. you have to be, you do have to be like, as they say, unstoppable and,
mm-hmm.
Undeniable. And I think, and I remember like promoting, hustling to promote, like trying to get people to come to just these like open mics and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I'm thinking, these people need to see who the young artists in their community are.
Yeah.
Right. Like yeah. they're going to love this.
Uh-huh.
And now as like a comic who's been 16 years or whatever in, I'm like, wow, like they're promoting an open mic? You know, it just shows you like how things
oh, yeah.
change. And then, but then like I reflect back on that romantically and think like, oh man, yeah, that was, you know, that was something else. You know, having that kind of passion about it is something you need mm-hmm. in those first 5 years for
oh,
sure.
Yeah.
Because it's just such a garbage time of show quality and all that kind of stuff. But there is something to be said for building that bridge and, you know, communicating. Because it is a conversation you're having with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not one-sided. They're laughing.
Right.
That's verbal communication,
mm-hmm.
I think, by definition. So it's, I don't know. Like, to me, there's nothing more beautiful than the Gutbuster because that's like an audience hearing something they've already thought that they've never had words for.
Yeah.
Even though they've thought it. They've had this thought, feeling, sensation, but they've never specifically defined it.
Right.
And then when you define it, that's when you get the biggest laugh there is.
Mm-hmm.
That's at least my thought on it.
Speaking to what the unknown knowns or the unknown unknowns, those things that were like, oh my God,
yeah.
I totally knew that, but I had no idea I even knew that.
And I don't think some people understand how important that is or how rare that is, just in communication in general.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, movies know how to push your emotional buttons, but that doesn't mean they're nailing you.
Mm-hmm.
Like the perfect joke can for someone. And the perfect joke for one person isn't the perfect joke for another person. But when you try to consider the idea that we as these animals haven't been speaking all that long to each other,
mm-hmm.
at least in these advanced, quote-unquote advanced ways that we consider to be advanced, we have all these thoughts, feelings, emotions, fears, desires, like inside of ourselves or, you know, surrounding ourselves in this consciousness, which still isn't defined. No one knows where this comes from. I cannot get over consciousness recently. Like it blows my mind, you
yeah.
know, pun intended, but like the idea that someone can put into words one of these deep feelings or emotions or thoughts that none of us truly even fully understand all the way. Like someone can nail it so perfectly, it instantly makes you guffaw and like
yeah.
erupt in laughter. To me, that's like, there's no bones about it. That is straight magic. It's straight
yeah.
up magic. And that's someone peering into your soul, taking something out of you and showing it back to you.
Yeah.
And that to me is like straight magic.
It's like when you, I mean, I think about the jokes where, I mean, we've all had jokes where you're like, you just can't wait to tell somebody else about it. Or you're like, oh man, you're like, you try to describe, you're like, oh man, there's this one comic had this one joke and it was so perfect because it does feel like it is speaking to a certain esoteric knowledge that you just have to, like, this thought bubble, this virus needs to spread. Like, more people need to know about I have just learned and what I've just seen. What part of I'm really curious about your whole dance with how you see your own art and spirituality. Well, you grew up Catholic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went to a Catholic school for 12 years. I was pretty in.
Uh-huh. Young Republican.
Yeah, I was. Before I was even a young Republican, I was a young priest. Like, I was like, I'm going to be a priest.
Wow.
But here's the problem with that. I wasn't like the guy who said, I'm going to be a priest when I grow up and serve people. I was the kid who was, I am God's next great leader.
Mm, the status part.
It went like Moses, Jesus, Ryan Singer, Dayton, Ohio, which is problematic. My mom tells a story of my brother and I, who we shared a room our whole lives growing up, which in hindsight was the greatest thing that's ever happened to me as far as being able to share space and, you know, not be obsessed with material goods. Mm. So... But anyway, that's a whole nother thing. But we were having the conversation a little boys have, and we're very similar in age. He's like barely a year older than me. And I was like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And so, like, they were eavesdropping on the conversation, like my parents or my mom was. And he's like, oh, I'm going to be a fighter pilot for the Air Force or something cool. And he's like, what about you? And I was like, I want to be a priest. He's like, a priest? Why would you want to be a priest? And this is what I said. I just see myself up there on that stage. And I tell everyone, Mass is ended, go in peace to love and serve the Lord. And everyone listens to me. Like, so first of all, I wanted it to be a stage.
Right.
I looked at it as a stage, not like a holy place of, like, you know, preaching. Right. And secondly, I just wanted people to listen to me.
Yeah.
You know, I was the middle child. Maybe that had something to do with it. But, you know, I wanted to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to performance space. And what better? And, you know, I have to say that as a kid, I was pretty smart. Because there is no better audience, no more attentive audience than one which believes the fate of their eternal soul rests on listening to you.
Sure.
So talk about a captive crowd.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, I think I don't know. I haven't thought about this. I have to preface this. I haven't thought of myself in this way. But when I think of, like, great ministers, I feel like that probably is a part of them. Even ones I love and I think are great and are super progressive and are, like, doing all the right, great kind of ministry in the world, I think there is a little bit of that prophetic feel of, I have something to say. I have a perspective that I need to share on God or Jesus or on the divine, or you know what I'm saying? Like, I think there is an impulse within any kind of religious leadership that, like,
it's gotta be, there's gotta be there. It's inherent.
So it's not inherent. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously ways it can turn narcissistic and nasty.
You're special enough or you are unique enough in some certain way that, like, oh, I have to do this. People need to hear this. I'm the one, I have to be the mouthpiece for this.
Yeah.
It's the same way to be president. Like, people, you know, we live in tumultuous political times right now. But I would make the argument, just like, this is not a political argument, but anyone who thinks they should be president is a maniac.
Right.
Like,
right.
Like, no matter how good they do at the job or how badly someone thinks they do at the job.
Right.
Anyone who thinks they should be president and be in charge of all these people or be the face of all these people.
Right.
There is huge ego. Mm-hmm. It's egomaniacal. And just by the sheer nature of thinking you are special enough to be that person.
Well, I've thought about this before, too, as somebody who has gone back and forth between being a critic of religion and an apologist at times of religion when people are like, well, religion, like, you know, people in the top of religious structures are all power hungry or sociopaths. And I would just, to me, it seems like sociopaths flock to the top of any power structure. Like, I feel like at certain lower levels, it's possible to be like a community leader and not really have that strong egoic sense, maybe a slight little bit of it, but I feel like lower, like, you know, like being a parish minister or community minister where you're not trying to like play any kind of games beyond, like you just want to be a good leader of your community, or like even a solid, let's say, I'm trying to like think of a parallel in the comedy world. Let's say like you just want to make it in comedy enough to make a living off of it. And that's kind of it. But then there's a certain amount of like the idea of wanting to rise to certain levels of fame and power in any, whether it's in politics or religion or any kind of social, any, sociopaths want to rise and be in control of people regardless of the system. And it's just like about fitting in. Oh, what system works for me? What do I, what language
and
can
we,
I speak?
And why wouldn't they? We reward it.
Right.
We reward it with praise and like fame and all this kind of stuff. I mean, like it's lauded. And I think what people don't understand is that we're all living inside of this system. And we don't understand there's this great book called The Lucifer Effect written by Dr. Philip Zimbardo. The guy who did the Stanford prison experiments.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
And it talks about how, like, in the right system, under the circumstances, any person, typically any person, will be affected by that system and will do things that maybe they don't think that they would ever do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's other examples throughout the book, but specifically the prison experiment, which I think most people are familiar with, about how these, like, just these volunteers turned into pretty much monsters.
Yeah.
And it's the littlest amount of power. It really changes people. And when you want to be like a leader of some kind, to not be poisoned by the, you know, the drive of the ego, mm-hmm. and the rewards that can come with it, I mean, is a task that I don't know if I'm up to. I highly doubt that I would be. Years ago, many, many years ago, I was emceeing for Dave Coulier, mm-hmm. and at a club in Cincinnati, and the audience was predominantly 25-year-old women,
mm-hmm.
who just were clamoring to get into the green room to see Uncle Joey. And not only that, they wanted Uncle Joey.
Sure.
And Dave Coulier is a good-looking guy, and you know, he takes care of himself, but like, so it's not like he's just some like how are all these women attracted to this man?
No, he's a funny guy.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. He's good looking. He's, you know, takes care of himself.
Lance
anyway,
Morissette liked him.
And he raised these women, you know. They mm-hmm. they grew up watching
right,
him.
Right.
So he's like super famous to them. The magic of the TV still baffles me. But like the and he was just in the green room, and to his credit, he's like, this is, you know, a waitress or somebody from the staff came, and they're like, you know, there's all these women out here, they want to like meet you. And he's like, please no, please keep the door closed.
Wow.
Please no.
Wow.
And she's like, and they're like, okay. And then he's like, he looked at me, he's like, I don't get it, man. He's like, I could be their father. This is like, it's like, wow. Gross. Like, what's going on? Like, this is like
Dave Coulier for president, man.
Right. And I looked at him and I was just like, I don't know if I said it, but I know I thought it. I said, well, it's a good thing you're you and I'm me, because if I were you, that door would be opening and closing every 5 minutes. You know
for
what
sure.
I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, this sounds like this is why we're in it, man. You know what I mean? Why, yeah. Why else are we doing this?
Yeah.
But so like the idea of like having like ultimate like power and privilege and fame thrust upon me isn't something that I strive for, because, well, for lots of reasons. One, because I've watched every VH1 Behind the Music there ever was, and I know that doesn't lead to happiness.
Right.
And two, because I know that I'm capable of anything. That's good and bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these people who thinks that they're not capable of the worst things.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sit here and act like that. I know for a fact, like if I'm going to sit here and pretend that I'm capable of greatness, I know I have to accept the fact that I'm capable of complete awfulness.
Oh
as
yeah.
Well,
I've seen in my own lifetime, you know, I've had stretches in my 20s where I was pretty internally explicitly selfish and like explicitly kind of like willing to sort of figure out whatever I needed to do to kind of to make life work for me, you know, kind of like any kind of nobler goals were sort of cast by the wayside. This is more my nihilistic period.
Sure.
So there is this awareness still in me that is certainly possible. And even I think like when I think of like, you know, I have my own, you know, little miniature missions or prophetic visions of, as I get into ministry, of things I would like to talk about, or change. But, I already sense it a little bit of a struggle. I think about like, what do I need to do to like get into seminary? What do I need to do to like get this job? Like, you know, there's, even if it never comes to the level of, I don't expect groupies to be knocking down my, my door, while I'm putting on my ministry robes or anything like that. I mean, maybe, who knows, but, just even like in the minor ways of, I mean, how many people come in to anything with these truly noble visions of change? And then it just comes down to like, well, I need to keep food on my table. I need to feed myself and my family. I just want, I want to have an okay house. And so I guess I won't rock the boat in the way that I envisioned rocking their boat. It takes real great courage and remarkable humans.
It's like the myth of the presidency about how, yeah, you know, someone's like, I'm going to be president. I'm going to tell the world about aliens and stuff. Right. Then, like, you win the election, and then the first thing they do is, like, the first thing they do when you get elected is they take you into a room. And
the
they show you a book that has all the secrets. And then you realize, oh, God, I can't do anything that I was going to do because this is not the reality of everything. You know, it's like, I don't believe that happens. But I'm not going to say some version of that doesn't like slowly occur throughout maybe the presidency, but I'm not conspiratorial in that way anymore to think that like you get elected and now you're taken into a room by like some guys who just always have that job,
right,
I guess.
The deep state.
Sure. Or yeah. So, and they just, you know, who knows? Because at the end of the day, we're all people. And I know coming from the paranormal world or like being a part of the paranormal community to say that we are all people is a very controversial statement. So we might not be, sure, but we're all some version of this creature that is interacting in a community here on the planet.
Right.
And it's more connected than it's ever been. And there's definitely ways to exploit one's position. And why wouldn't you? When it's like we were saying earlier, when it's like encouraged, and not only it's encouraged, especially in the West, especially here in the United States, the capitalism has become the new religion almost.
Yeah.
And there's a musician, Matthew Ryan, who wrote a really thoughtful, like, I guess it was just a blog about this, about how capitalism has become like an extremist ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And to even speak ill of capitalism at all, and even in the faintest way, there's huge backlash. And much like in the ways of the past when you couldn't even, when you couldn't question religion at all.
Yeah.
And you are a heretic almost. So now that you, now you can be a heretic when it comes to capitalism.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy. Like I had this experience with my mom and stepdad recently at their house. We were talking and I said something about capitalism and like they lost their mind. And I'm just like, I can't, I guess we can't have this conversation.
Yeah. It's deeply embedded.
It's deeply embedded and there's inherent goodness in it. And to me, it's probably one of the overarching problems of, it's the thing that influences in a very problematic way, almost all of our problems here in the United States. Yeah.
Well, that's what I think is fascinating about, you know, we talk about like Catholic, like the Catholic priest or the Catholic monk who takes vows of celibacy, takes vows of ascetic living, of a vow of poverty. And these are people that are still alive here and now. Like these people really exist. Or like even the artist who takes on, you know, even if it's not an explicit vow of poverty, it's kind of an implicit, like I'm probably going to be poor for a lot of my artistic life. But
there's a lot of really happy poor artists.
Yeah. Well,
and a lot of miserable rich people.
I found out one of my favorite, like one of my favorite musicians, where you know they're on one of my like playlists for like getting for my pre-show like playlist type things I play before all my shows, and I found out like, oh, she has like roommates in Echo Park, you know, and then somebody was like, wow, like I thought she like toured. I'm like, no, she does, but that's just how.
Yeah, it's just how. That's just life.
That's just life. But I think there's something really. I mean. That is that in and of itself. When you tell people that, I mean, you talk about like capitalism being just a deeply embedded form of ideology. That's like, that scares people and freaks people. Like, but why do you want to be poorer your whole life?
But see, that's why it's so effective too. Because we've been, I mean, and I have to keep in mind that I have to keep a sense of humor about all the things I believe in, or I can sound like a jerk. Everybody, that's just the truth with everybody.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And so, like, I'm not trying to, like, take down capitalism right now.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what makes me mad. And it makes me mad because it wasn't that long ago that I shook free from it. And I see a lot of people are still in its grips. In the United States of America, you are made to feel like a failure if you don't have opulence. Mm. If you don't have luxury, like overabundance,
right,
is success.
Right.
And if you don't have that, you are made to feel like a failure. Mm-hmm. I have roommates. I have three roommates. I'm 42 years old. I'm pretty happy. Like, as far as, like, I have friends who are extremely more successful than me. And if I had to measure our happiness, I've got them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, I don't want to, like, sit here and kind of, like, poo-poo on someone else's happiness. But just from knowing them, it's like they're always miserable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I don't get miserable sometimes. Certainly I do. But, like, but this idea of if you don't own your home, if you don't have your own home, which... some people are going to think this is crazy, but owning your own home is a luxury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, act like it's not to 90% of the rest of the world.
That's right.
You know, having a vacation home is above and beyond overabundance.
Mm-hmm.
And let alone having, like, you know, because part of me is like, I want my apartment in LA. I want my mountain house in Lake Arrowhead.
Oh, yeah.
And I want a home back in Ohio. Oh, yeah, for when I visit.
I'm like, that as is guilty crazy. Of wanting all these things as
that's
anybody.
That's insane.
Yeah, yeah.
There's people sleeping on top of each other everywhere in the world right now. And I'm thinking like, oh, I haven't made it. I don't have my own house. I don't have my own $1 million house in Los Angeles. That's a one bedroom.
Oh, yeah. Like the studio I live in that I, you know, I'm like, oh, it's only a studio. This people would kill for this
studio.
This
place is awesome.
Yeah.
No, this place is amazing.
It is great.
Yeah, So the idea that like we've all been brainwashed and it's happened to all of us and it still affects me on a daily basis. This idea of what success is. What we did is we surrendered success to a system that we didn't choose, that we were born into or whatever, but we didn't get to choose it. So like for me, that's where life really starts grooving into like a good place.
Mm-hmm.
When you realize that and you decide like, you know what, why am I going to let other people be in charge of my happiness?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but for some reason it took me too long to learn it. So once I realized that I get to decide what my success is, especially in entertainment business, because if we aren't making huge steps forward, even if we're just holding steady, mm-hmm. we feel like we're free falling into obscurity.
Yeah.
And which is the weird thing. And maybe it's that way in other fields as well, but I can only speak to this field. But that's a weird thing. Like, that shouldn't be the case. Like, oh, you're holding steady and you have a good spot in the industry. No, I'm dying over here. Mm-hmm. It's like, no. It's like, why is that so crazy like that? So once I realize that I get to make my own success, because other people who think they're your friends, and they are your friends, and they think they're helping you out by saying, why don't you have... why haven't you done,
yeah.
why do they have this when you are so much
mm-hmm.
like, whoa, man, you're poisoning me. Don't bring your poison to my pot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's like now we're getting into hierarchical thinking and like comparisons and like I'm only happy in comparison. Like I was doing just a minute ago to my friends. Mm-hmm. I'm so much happier than my friends are. And they're, you know, like, so see, I still do it.
Of course.
But yeah, so once I start taking control of my own happiness, and it's a daily struggle, like that's when I realize, like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm okay where I'm at.
Well, that's, you're reminding me of, I want to say it was Alan Watts, but it might have been somebody else talking about, like, it's a weird thing when we want to, like, assist. It is, first of all, it's like weird to, like, navigate this plane of like wanting to help the poor and help the needy, but also like tell them that helping them is like giving them, like making them want more material things, you know. Like there's certain, like we're like, oh, people are struggling in America because they don't have X, Y, and Z, like, you know what I'm saying? So it is a weird, it is like almost poisoning their well. But then on the other hand, the total extreme wealth inequality is really gross to me. And so I don't even know what to do with it. You know,
yeah, I mean, I drive around fantasizing of having a Subaru Outback,
mm-hmm.
driving it to my mountain home in Lake Arrowhead. You know what I mean? Oh, I need an all-wheel drive vehicle for my mountain house.
Mm-hmm.
you know, because of the snow.
Well, that something
I can't have my Toyota Camry from 2006, which is perfectly fine as a vehicle.
Right.
I need a better, more luxurious vehicle.
Well, see, to me, that what you're describing is not even some of the aspect of what you're describing is less. When I love the vision of it, isn't just about like wanting to be cloaked in luxury and warmly heated and things, but it's freedom. The idea of freedom, of being able to totally control my time. Being able to have absolutely the entire say over exactly what I do, freedom of mobility, freedom of access. There's always going to be things that there's good. I don't know if it's our nature as human beings to always want these hierarchies, but you know, if we all have free access to information, now there's a certain hierarchy of like, well, there's actually secret information that not everybody gets to get.
See, this is a beautiful thing you bring up, because when it comes to the idea of having our freedom, which is inherently like the thing we want the most. That's why I like to try, you know, I mess with my friends. I can't have pets in my apartment building. So I like to mess with my friends and tell them, no matter how much you think your dog or cat loves you, it longs for, subconsciously, it longs for its freedom. And it would take it, even if it wouldn't be able to consciously take it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, my dog would die without me, or my cat comes back if it gets out. It's like, yeah, but consciously doesn't know how to free itself.
Yeah.
Because it's been a slave for so long. So anyway, but like they'll get mad at me about that, right? And pet, you know, animal lovers always get mad at me. Well, you don't understand like the origin of a dog. It's a weak wolf, blah, 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 blah. People love doing that argument.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you're going to try to tell me any sentient creature doesn't want its own freedom? Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it gets to choose who it spends its time with. Does it choose to be with you? Then fine. But I will say this. The idea that we now believe that our freedom is tied into money,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like the greatest trick capitalism ever pulled.
Mm-hmm.
Because we now totally disregard the idea that we are these free creatures without money. And in fact, money does the opposite of freeing us. It makes us, it makes us a slave to it, portending to give us its, you know, our freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And so like now we believe we have to operate inside of a system to achieve a certain thing to get our freedom, when we're born with freedom, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's such a trickster, huckster system, and I don't have the solution to get out of it.
Yeah, me either. It's so tough. I was actually, when I was driving down, recording this the day after the election, the most midterm elections, and I was driving from the Bay Area down to LA yesterday, and part of my drive was listening to like to various radio stations that I could of like the election results, and I guess they have Democracy Now, like radio station was like playing for like a good chunk of that near the Bay Area, so I was tuning in to these extreme progressive like they would self-classify themselves as like far left or leftist type people, and describing this like this inherent problem between as ultra progressives, if you want to call it that, there's a constant battle of like, well, we either have to settle for the lesser of these evils in the Democratic Party, because they view like the elites in the Democratic Party as still having all these problems of capitalism, while still having these old ways of thinking, and yet the other solution or the other alternative is this extremely fascist like alternative in their opinion. And so, in the same way, I feel this conflict, and we're talking about this stuff because, like, yes, I totally am with you that our capitalistic system and the idea that money equals freedom is fundamentally is bullshit on like this on a cosmic level. And yet I see when we talk about different levels of wealth and wealth inequality, that does seem to lead to a degree of differing levels of freedom and ability to achieve happiness in this country.
Access, privilege,
right.
Yeah, all that stuff.
And
for
so
sure.
It's like, how do we, I mean, what's the solution? We have to like, almost feed the beast a little bit while also trying to kill it at the same time.
Yeah, it is weird. I mean, like, I guess that made me think of like how you feed a cow. You get a cow real fat so you can eat it better. But so, you know, for people who like are growing cattle or
right.
have cattle, but there is something about the idea of, you know, like the ultra progressive to, and my friend, this great musician, Austin Lucas, he knows like a lot about this kind of stuff, but it's the like the fundamental flaw in like certain, or one of the big flaws, I don't know if it's a fundamental flaw, in like, you know, left-wing politics is the idea of you have to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Expecting someone to be perfect. And it's impossible for
it's
anyone.
Purity. Yeah.
Yeah, it's impossible to be perfect. And like, I'm a hypocrite in every way, shape, and form. I can admit that. I mean, I believe that money is a prison. I play the Powerball. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I understand the system I live in. I mean, my roommate's reading a book about that hermit who made it for 27 years in the woods somewhere before he got caught. And he was like a gentleman thief, as they called him.
Oh, really?
He would just go steal what he needed to survive.
Oh, I never heard that guy.
And there's this book written about him. Anyway, so I guess there's ways to get off the grid and quote unquote be free.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, if I was honest with myself, I don't want to be free from people.
Mm-hmm.
I need it. I need communication. That's why I'm a performer. I want to perform for people, and I want to have those people give me money to perform for them so I can pay my rent.
Totally.
And I understand that the system I'm living inside of is not something you can change overnight. I mean, you can mentally change anything you want, but the actual material world, there's, God, what's the guy's name? Pretiram Sorokin. Or Sorokin?
I don't know.
This is one of these books I haven't even read yet that I'm getting ready to reference.
Right.
I think it's called The Crisis of Our Age is the book that he wrote. And he talks about like the transitioning from basically like from what my dumb mind can understand. It's transitioning from like this mystical intuition-based feeling of, you know, self into very like... the very, I guess, would it be pragmatic, like science-based, like evidence, and how we've just totally disregarded our intuition and all this other kind of like this woo-woo stuff that people always like to shit on nowadays.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When, like, Homo sapien, the word sapien is derivative of sapience, which is like, you know, it's like intuitive knowledge, right?
It's like I heard actually Richard Rohr, one of my one of his books is on my coffee table here. He has an awesome he's a Catholic priest. One of his awesome lectures is on the Sermon on the Mount, but he talks about how I think Homo sapien means like wise man. Basically, we named ourselves wise men.
Yeah.
When we've been around for like such an infinitesimally small sure. amount of time.
It is funny because I can't remember the scientist or the person's name who named Homo sapien.
Mm-hmm.
But it came from a Latin word, sapientius or something.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, like at the heart of it, it's like this creature that has intuitive knowledge,
mm-hmm.
that acquired wisdom intuitively, which, you know, you try to talk about your intuition nowadays and you get like what are you? You probably have crystals. Yeah, I do have crystals. But we've totally disregarded our intuition. But everybody knows they can walk into a party, and if a couple just had a fight in that room, everybody knows something weird. The energy's off in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows that. They're feeling the energy. So disregarding our intuition in a very extreme way recently, with very popular scientists that are like all over the television right now, want you to feel like an idiot.
Right.
If you put any credence to the idea that you're a mystical being.
Well, there's a fallacy. I mean, and this is, there's a certain fallacy of rationality, and this cult of rationality that it's even possible to be fully rational. And I mean, I think all of us can appreciate a degree of rationality and skepticism to be objective.
I love understanding the world around me and my place within it because it gives me a sense of security to a degree.
Right. And yet we never fully appreciate our biases, it seems like, or fully appreciate whatever privilege we have or fully appreciate like sometimes I got into I was up with my cousin in Sacramento and we just were struck up a conversation at a bar with somebody, and I mentioned that I was like going into ministry, and they bristled. I'm like, no, it's okay. Unitarian Universalist. Like that's not what you think it is. But they were still like, they were in this camp of being I'm a hyper rational atheist. Like I'm a pure atheist. Everything else is
fun guy at a party.
Right. But there's so much I don't know. It's one of those weird things where if you asked me about any given specific idea of God, I would not be I'd be an atheist towards most identified forms of God. And that, you know, I'm going to like, you know, how Saint Aquinas, Aquinian theology is the idea of you can only describe what God isn't. You can't really describe what God is. I kind of maybe fall in that camp. And yet I know I feel like there is something greater beyond me. I don't feel like I have all the answers. And I do, you're describing this. I have intuitions and I have, you get a vibe, you get a feeling, and that there's a certain amount of that is just, it's hard to say, but it's just plain
they can't
truth.
Describe. No one's described where consciousness came from or what it is.
Nope.
No one has done that. Neil deGrasse Tyson, tell me what consciousness is.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me that it cannot exist after the physical form is gone,
mm-hmm.
and maybe be a ghost. You know what I mean? But I mean, you even suggest that to someone like him, he'll like be like, "You're an idiot. I have a doctorate."
Yeah.
Like, we don't have the high priest anymore. We have the high scientist. And guys like him love to shit on people who are, you know, he won't even have conversations with some of these other fringe scientists. But like, and I love a lot of the stuff that guy does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed like the graphics and like the production value of the new Cosmos series because I love space stuff. Some of his digs I could do without. I mean, it's like,
sure.
You're really going overboard here just to make sure everybody knows who you think you are. But, you know, he's the self-anointed successor of Carl Sagan.
Right,
so, like,
right.
He takes that very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like, it's so funny when someone wants to be the face of space.
Right.
And, you know, that's what he clearly wants to be the face of space. And anyway, it's pretty funny to me. But the point is, like, we don't know where consciousness come from, or we don't know what it is. Like,
How it arises.
Like, I have a pet theory of mine is that it was a gift. It's an advanced technology gifted to us from aliens, whatever that alien might be. So, I mean, that's just a fun thought that I have.
Sure.
That comes from my consciousness.
Right.
But like, at the same time, I know where babies come from. I know, well, let me say it this way. I know how babies are made, but no one has ever explained where babies come from.
Mm.
No one has ever explained the miracle of life, the spark of life,
right.
Prana, or whatever, the soul, or like, no one has ever been able to use the scientific method to show this. And to me, that's where these mystery schools and esoteric knowledge and the paranormal. And sometimes I wonder if the problem with paranormal investigations, which I do, is like that there's like just an inherent flaw in the way we go about it, because we are trying to measure the supernatural with natural means, with natural tools.
Yeah.
And is that even possible? And a large part of me would like to think that it is possible to, you know, try to find, if you find enough circumstantial evidence,
mm-hmm.
You can make yourself a pretty good case.
You're speaking exactly to what I have this professor, Dr. Bart Ehrman, in undergrad, who I was a religious studies major in college, and that's what made me not be a Christian anymore. But he was a former evangelical pastor who turned. He's now one of the most renowned like New Testament academics out there, and agnostic. But he's devil's advocates, his own argument by saying like, we don't have evidence that miracles happen. We don't have scientific evidence that these miracles happen, but we wouldn't, because the fact that they are miracles means they are supernatural, meaning if we had evidence for it, we would just incorporate it into our understanding of the natural world. Like, if something is truly miraculous, it hasn't been documented scientifically. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying, because there's, you know, and I'm bastardizing the phrase, the quote, but I think it's Sir George Fraser or James Fraser, or he's the guy who wrote The Golden Bough,
mm-hmm.
That compendium of like all the world's religions or whatever. I own the book, but I haven't even been, I'm like, I look at it, I'm like, oh
sure.
God, this is almost 600 pages of small type.
That's me and the young book I have.
Yeah. And it's like, he talks about how, you know, magic is just science yet defined.
Mm.
And so when it comes to like stuff like magnetism and you know, it used to be a magic rock, you mm-hmm. know, that could like attract another thing to it. Mm-hmm. But then magnetism came about, or we discovered like electromagnetic fields and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm really on board with that whole concept of it wouldn't be supernatural, because now we would know, like, especially like turning water into wine or, mm-hmm. you know, just alchemy in general to me is like pretty cool to think about.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like alchemy, like chemistry of God, of the gods or whatever, mm-hmm. You know, the breakdown of that word means. So it's just like, who's not interested in alchemy, man? Like,
yeah.
You're talking about God chemistry? Like, you know, I've been binging Vikings, that TV show. I think it was on the History Channel, but it's on Prime for free.
Yeah.
And like, and it's a really interesting conversation about the battle between like, you know, belief systems is what's happening in the show between the Vikings who have, you know, Odin and Thor. They have all their gods in Valhalla. And then you have the Christian world. Yeah. And so it's like them trying to, you know, deal with each other. And you have people who are just like, anyone who's a Christian must die. Anyone who's a pagan must die, you know? And then you have other people who are like, oh no, I'm interested to know about all these other things.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it is like when it comes to trying to understand or figure out, the beautiful thing about it is that the human mind will always figure out a way to ask another why.
Totally.
And that's something that's really difficult for me to have to accept.
It's difficult for me too. But what I love about, one of the things I love about, and the only way I think I really could be a minister is if I was going into Unitarian Universalism, where, as you're describing, we... most religions have some kind of orthodoxy, some kind of correct belief that you basically need to come to the conclusion of, or you're not really allowed to explore other religions, at least authentically. You can kind of be like, oh, well, there's a lot of Christians who have a solid, maybe interfaith appreciation of, oh, Muslims are different. They just believe different things. And that's like good for them. But like, there's not really space to like, well, let's actually try to like worship like Muslims worship. Like, let's, you know? And so I just am so endlessly fascinated by, yeah, incorporating, like, I want to learn more about paganism. I want to learn.
Cause
more
there's
about,
so much more in common between,
oh yeah,
like Islam and Christianity than there is a difference.
Oh, for sure.
And like in Judaism and all those others. And basically every religion ever. Mm-hmm. I think you could probably argue that. I mean, I don't know. It's pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, when it comes to like trying to, and we like to box ourselves, you know, I mean, like we were talking about, like identifying our world around us helps us feel safe. Mm-hmm. So accepting we don't know is a really, it's a fear-based way of life. But I think the beautiful thing about being an entertainer is, or in like even a parapsychologist. I was listening to a parapsychologist give a, you know, he was on a podcast I was listening to as I took a late night walk the other night. And they were talking about new experiments they're doing with like the double slit mm-hmm. and other things, trying to figure out, you know, being able to use psychokinesis to control whether something will appear as like a wave or a particle. Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, actually using science for this stuff. And he said something about to be an effective parapsychologist, you have to have the right temperament. He said, you have to be comfortable living in a world of ambiguity. Mm. And not everyone's built for that. And that really resonated with me. I was like, oh, that's what being a comedian is.
Yeah.
Or someone who wants to be a writer or an actor or an artist, or, you know, when you don't have like a fixed income or something, mm-hmm. which still has some ambiguity to it because you don't know if the company's going to survive. But going from day to day, not knowing where your money's coming from in the future, it's like you really have to lean into ambiguity. You have to be comfortable living on the float.
Yeah.
And yeah. Not everybody can do that. And that doesn't make me better than someone who doesn't want to do that. It's just, we're just different. It doesn't, you know, there's no better than there. But there is a certain type of person who thrives in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely one of those people who loves the ambiguity. And I think it shows in all the things I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, that's like how I've talked about this a lot before on my podcast of, that's what the purpose, from what I understand, of Zen koans was for teaching aspiring Zen masters was, now, do you know, are you aware of what koans are? Like these little, like, essentially they're riddles that back for centuries when, you know, aspiring Zen masters would be in their, they'd be living in the monastery. They'd be each given like a riddle or like a phrase that they were trying to like one would be like, what was your face before you were born? And they were supposed to have to, each student is supposed to have, like, try to come up with an answer to that to the Zen master. And of course it's like an unanswerable question. And of course they're, whatever they say is going to be wrong, but they would slowly, the course of their training would ideally lead them slowly to start to realize, oh, I don't, there's no way I can possibly know. And as soon as they
look these up,
as soon as they, they're awesome. Yeah. But as soon as they would give like an authentic reaction, that's when the Zen master would be like, all right, now you're good. Like, now you're stopped trying, like, now that you've stopped trying to give some spiritually pretentious answer, like, because, you know, they would go through the whole gamut.
My face
of,
is the face of all who right, have come before and will be.
Exactly. I have the Buddha face or whatever it is. Yeah. And they'd be like, nope, fuck you. Like, you know, and they would even do, like, they would even slap them in certain cases. Like, they would just do nonsensical, like, their style of teaching would always be some kind of, like, yeah, totally just, like, throwing, flipping the table on
knock you off balance and try to see who, right. See what you are.
Because it's, they understood that there's just a certain element of living in ultimate reality, of living in ultimate emptiness, is dealing with stuff that will just never possibly
the unknowingness.
Know. Yeah.
And that, to me, that's like a beautiful thing in, like, on paper, you know, and then, but also understanding that I strive to know.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there's a reason I just had to buy 2 bookcases for my room. And it's like, because I'm trying to know, everything. And it's like, I don't have the time.
Yeah.
I don't have the time to know everything. And, like, I don't want to be a know-it-all. You know what I do? I do want to know how to do hypnosis, self-hypnosis. I want to know how to do psychokinesis. I want to know astral projection. I want to know, you know, like, the city. Like, I want to be able to achieve superpowers from becoming a master yogi. Like, I want all that stuff. I want clairvoyance. Yeah. I want to be able to mind read. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to, you know, see into the future. And I do believe that it's possible to achieve these things. Like, but people spend their whole lives, like, doing one small facet of one of these things. And I'm like, right. I'm going to do it all. You know, right. it's like, I don't know if that's a good way to learn something. It is a good way to be able to communicate and maybe, you know, pique someone's interest in some of these topics. Like, uh-huh. Like I think I do with, like, my comedy now, but it's definitely no way to become an expert.
Oh yeah. No, I struggle through that same thing. Well, we're about out of time. I feel like I could talk for quite a while. This is great. I wanted to ask you.
It's already been. Oh wow.
Yeah. I don't know if you need to run out. We can just end it here. But, like, I just have one last question.
Oh no. Well, yeah. Let's do the last question.
Do you? I guess it's multifaceted. Do you consider yourself a spiritual person, or how do you define spirituality, and do you have a spiritual life? Would you
no
say?
Doubt about it. I'm definitely spiritual, and excuse me. There was a time in my life where I would have said I was not. I went from being, like, very religious to not religious at all, like, on purpose. So basically overcompensating for hating the fact that I was still religious, to kind of coming to a comfortable place of not knowing and, like, not obsessing about it anymore, mm-hmm. to now where I'm in a place where I'm definitely spiritual. And there's no face of God for me. Like when I grew up, mm-hmm. you know, the classic face of God that's, you know, sitting up in heaven waiting for me right. to get in the gates.
Or at least the guy on the cross.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And so there's no face of God for me anymore, but I do understand that for me, God is the mystery. And, I mean, if I had to, like, define God, I'm kind of in that Thomas Aquinas school as well. It's like, you can define by what he's not or what it's not. But if I was, like, forced to try to put some kind of description to it, I would say it's the mystery of the unknown, and simultaneously everything that is also known.
Yes.
So it's like that ultimate paradox. I love Hermeticism, and I love the idea of the paradox, and, you know, basically just jumbo shrimp. God is jumbo shrimp.
Yeah. Have you read the Tao Te Ching?
I have that book. I think I read it many years ago, so I don't really remember it. But it's
Yeah, it's full of those awesome little paradoxes.
Yeah, and I read recently, I'm trying to think, I read like The Emerald Tablet.
Haven't read that one.
And there's all these different, like, you know, I love all those kind of like spiritual journey books.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's one of my favorites of all time is Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, where it's the gorilla who knows everything.
Interesting.
It's such a good book. Huh. I mean, you want to talk about like transference. You want to talk about like some real like mystical stuff happening. I went to the Burbank Library and I found that book on the bottom shelf. So I'm on my knees already, right? So almost as if like the universe was like, get on your knees for this book. And so I find the book, because I didn't think they had it. I was looking and couldn't find it. And then finally, I pull it out, the book, and then I instantly feel all the emotions of the 100 people who have read that book before me.
Wow.
Like, at least this is how I'm framing it, because I was overcome with emotion. And because it was like an old used copy.
Mm.
And this book is so good that I finished it in like a day and a half probably. But like you can, like once I finished the book, the experience I had when I first touched the book became more clear to me. So I'm like, I really experienced a lot emotionally, like in my soul when I read this book. So that made a lot of sense to me. But like, I love all that stuff. And so there's like zero doubt that I'm a spiritual guy because of that. Because I'm on a spiritual quest of some kind.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's definable, but you know, a lot of it, you know, sometimes I'm reading, you know, what is it? Not Ishmael. God, there's so many books now I can't even remember, but like, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, but he wrote a different book that's so good. Illusions by Richard Bach.
Mm.
Such a good book. Anyway, it's a similar book, but whether I'm like reading Illusions by Richard Bach or I'm like hanging out in the woods late at night hoping Bigfoot shows up, it's kind of all the same thing,
connecting to something like greater.
Yeah, like, oh, most people don't believe this is real.
Yeah.
Well, let's see if I can find it. You know what I mean?
I love that, man. Well, thank you for coming on, man. We haven't really talked much besides this conversation.
Yeah, this was great. This was fun.
This is great. Love your album. Everybody should get it. Free Love.
Free Love. It's free.
It's free.
It's free. It's for sale on iTunes and Amazon. I don't want people to buy it. I want them to rate and review it, you know, 5 stars.
Right.
And write a nice review, but I don't want them to buy it. But I do want them to review it and rate it. Just because so more people will see it if it rises up in like, you know, popularity. But my website, RyanSingerComedy.com, has download links for Google Drive and or Dropbox, depending on which one you prefer.
And you can get it on your podcast feed for Me and Paranormal.
Yes, I put it up as the 400th episode.
Yeah.
And it's also Spotify, Pandora, all that, Sirius Satellite Radio. You know, you can request it there. I mean, they've got it all.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, Joe.
That's the show. Thank you for listening. Come out to the live Choose Your Own Religion on January 25th, 7:30 p.m. at Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church. I hope to see you there. Leave a rating or review if you like the show. Send me an email to joe@chooseyourownreligion if you want to talk about anything or if you want to tell a story. I love you. Namaste.
Hey, do you like Christmas?
Uh-huh.
Do you like Christmas movies, good or bad?
Yeah.
Do you like podcasts?
Yes.
Do you want a podcast that reviews awesome Christmas movies that a lot of people think that are bad?
Yes!
Well, Ross, you're in this podcast.
Wait, what?
Yeah, you're co-hosting this podcast with me, Jackie.
Let's do it!
And we have special guests. It's called Most Wonderful Pod of the Year, brought to you by Campfire Media.
Oh, I love it.
So you can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, I'm going right now. Here's my phone.
Merry Christmas. Let's ring in the holiday.
Campfire.